from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's opening forum hour, a new study from the University of Guelph in Canada finds that many herbal supplements are diluted or replaced with fillers, such as wheat and rice, that aren't listed on their labels. Using a technique called DNA barcoding, researchers discovered that many products were misleadingly labeled, and critics of the multi-billion-dollar-a-year supplement industry say it is defrauding consumers and that FDA regulation is inadequate. Industry groups claim the study is flawed. We'll discuss the findings and what they mean for consumers. That's up next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. We'll be talking in this hour about the reliability of dietary supplements, but first we want to get an update on today's initial public offering by San Francisco-based company Twitter. And we're joined now by Paul Sloan, who is executive editor of CNET, and he's here in San Francisco by phone with us. Good morning, Paul Sloan.
Good morning.
I guess let's begin by talking about the share price. It's right now between $45 and $46, and that's up 75% from where it was priced. What does this mean?
It means there's a ton of excitement, and there's a lot of people playing this Vegas style, and it's a lot of momentum. And the sense is if it's going to go up, it might keep going up, and that might, in fact, be true. So people are hopping on.
Any advice to investors maybe thinking of hopping on?
Beware. I'm not really one to give stock advice, but look, this was anytime you get a deal with such excitement like this and there's such demand and it has this kind of pop, you have to realize that these are quick traders. These are not people that very few people should get in. I would argue at 76% above the price that it was set that the institutional and professional investors got in at, and then expect to do well over time. Of course, it might do well, but it's always risky. IPOs are risky. Twitter loses money; it doesn't make money, and we just don't know how it's going to play out. This is initial excitement.
Have any flashbacks to 1999?
Well, for sure, though not across the board. Right, we haven't seen a lot of this. And obviously, this is the biggest since Facebook, and Facebook was more of a face plant, right? I mean, it did not do well out of the gate, and that was that this is the opposite for a number of reasons.
Well, they probably learned a great deal from that, wouldn't you say? I mean, that they gleaned a good deal from that the mistakes Facebook made?
Yes, they learned a lot. They learned don't flood the market with shares at the last minute. They learned price it conservatively to start with, or what's perceived as conservatively. They are using the New York Stock Exchange instead of the NASDAQ, which unfortunately had a whole lot of technical glitches, which didn't help for Facebook. And they were more cautious. And frankly, Twitter's doing well because Facebook now is doing well. If Facebook was still still hurting as a stock, it wouldn't be a good time for Twitter to go public. So it's sort of a perfect storm for Twitter. And for all those reasons, it's doing well. I do think there's a whole lot of people out there that would love a return to 1999. And so they think somehow the memory is distant enough, at least the pain part, that they think this time we can get in and get out. And, power to them. I don't think we have a return to 99 on any broad level. But I think there's enough momentum and excitement and greed out there that's what people would like.
Paul Sloan is with us by phone, executive editor of CNET. Before I let you go, Paul, does this mean, I mean, if you can conjecture, anything for users?
The only thing it might mean for users is Twitter is now going to be under a lot of pressure to make money, and that they have not done yet. And that means advertising in all kinds of ways we have not seen. So it's hard to tell. That's always a delicate balance between ads and the user experience. Facebook has managed to inject a lot of ads without a lot of pushback from its members or users. So we don't know really how aggressive Twitter will get, but they have to be mindful of that now. They have to answer to shareholders. They can't just answer to themselves.
And again, Paul Sloan, executive editor of CNET. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Pleasure.
And by the way, for more on Twitter IPO, tune into Monday on Forum when my guest will be New York Times tech reporter Nick Bilton, who's the author of Hatching Twitter, a true story of money, power, friendship, and betrayal. But as promised, we're going to talk in this opening hour about supplements, and particularly about herbal supplements. Scientists in Canada released data earlier this week as a result of DNA testing revealing that many herbal supplements are frequently diluted or completely replaced by inexpensive fillers such as wheat, rice, or soybeans. 44 herbal products sold by 12 companies were tested, and nearly 60%, according to the study's published results, contained plant species not listed on the label, while product substitutes were in nearly a third, and over a fifth had fillers not listed at all on the labels. There are, by the way, roughly 29,000 herbal products and substances sold throughout North America in what is calculated to be a $5 billion a year industry. We want to discuss these new findings in this opening forum hour, as well as what specific kinds of regulations, if any, are needed in order to, get control of this market of herbal supplements, which just keeps on proliferating. Let me tell you who's joining us for the hour. Candy Sarunas is here with us in studio. She's professor of clinical pharmacology at the UCSF School of Pharmacy, that is University of California, San Francisco, and welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. We also have Dr. Daniel Fabricant with us, we're going to have Dr. Fabricant with us. We have Mark Blumenthal with us, who's founder and executive director of the American Botanical Council. Let me say good morning to you. Glad to have you.
Good morning, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and let me begin with Candy Sarunas, who's here with us in studio. There's a lot that has come out with this. I mean, it's been played up in the New York Times, and it's gotten a lot of media attention. And I know that really the bottom line for you is concern with the consumer. So let me just actually talk about, in general, what we're talking about in terms of dangers here. If these things aren't labeled right, I guess kids are in danger, who have people with allergies in general, or those who want products gluten-free. There's a whole range, isn't there?
There is. People of all ages and within any life stage are essentially at risk. Even though we call these herbs, they're medicines, essentially. And when anyone takes something that they don't know that they're taking, you're putting yourself at risk for drug interactions, severe allergic reactions. The list goes on and on. I'm actually quite, surprised, but also disappointed by what they
found. And maybe concerned for consumers.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Steve Neumaster, who's the lead author on this, said that there are real health risks not only associated with this kind of herbal product fraud, but he said there aren't any standards. And that is obviously a concern here, too. It has to be brought into the whole discourse on this.
Well, there are standards, but the standards that exist clearly don't catch products like this, and that there are circumstances where manufacturers are maybe not doing the job that they should be doing. And this is one example where you have an independent group that spot tests a particular sampling, in this case, 44 supplements. And this is really concerning.
Yeah, I should have said, there are standards, but we'll talk to somebody from the FDA. The problem is, of course, as you suggest, enforcing those standards. But there is some legitimate new research, isn't there, in this? And yet perhaps some see it as being overblown or not using enough samples. How do you regard the research itself?
I think that if we were to do the same test for pharmaceutical products and over-the-counter medicines, we wouldn't see what we're seeing here with the dietary supplement industry. And that, to me, is very concerning. We have very strict standards for these other medicines, but yet for dietary supplements, there's sort of this variability that we're seeing. And I think these manufacturers need to instead, move away from criticizing the validity of this study and very carefully look at their procedures and how they're dealing with these ingredients, because they're purchasing them from the global marketplace. And we need to have a responsible way of making sure that we're formulating a finished product that meets all these requirements.
Is it fair to say that manufacturers have been given an effective free rein since 1994?
I would say absolutely.
So let me go to you, if I may, Mark Blumenthal. Mark Blumenthal is founder and executive director of the American Botanical Council. You think this study is erroneous and ought to be retracted. Why?
Because there are a number of areas of confusion. There's a great deal of concern about methodological flaws. There's ambiguities. There's outright errors of fact in the paper, so at least it needs to be revisited, rewritten, in some cases clarified by the authors. That needs to be submitted to probably a more robust peer review process than it apparently had gone through, and only then it needs to be republished when it's been properly vetted. There are a number of errors of fact, some of which may or may not be worth discussing right now. One of them, since we're talking about regulations, they claim that the this is an egregious one, that the Canadian Food Inspection Agency regulates herbal dietary supplements in Canada. That's not the truth. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency basically inspects food items, but doesn't regulate dietary supplements, which in Canada are sold as a class of goods called natural health products, and these are actually a division of medicines or drugs, not dietary supplements in Canada, and they're regulated by an entirely different agency. So even in their own country, because these are all Canadian researchers, they didn't even get the regulatory aspect, a basic issue, correct. Now, that's a relatively minor point on some levels, but it also maybe informs how maybe some other aspects of this paper weren't adequately vetted by knowledgeable peer reviewers to ensure that its accuracy when it's published.
Well, on the other hand, when you read through this paper, you get concerns about things that are widely used, like echinacea or St. John's wort or ginkgo biloba. And I wonder, just if I may, in general, if you're not perhaps skeptical or critical of this whole DNA-based analysis, how reliable is it, or how is it appropriately
used?
Well,
thank you for asking that. DNA-based analysis actually is a very reliable technique. It's been around for about a decade or so, and it's, I think, going to be informing a lot of the future of quality control procedures for good manufacturing practices in the American herbal industry and elsewhere. But the question is, the DNA analysis has to be fit for purpose, which is a term of art. It has to be used appropriately. For example, DNA analysis is excellent when you're analyzing plant material, but it is inadequate when you're analyzing plant extracts. And in this particular paper that we're talking about, it's still ambiguous and unclear as to what extent, if any, some of the products may contain plant extracts, because if it were extracts, powdered extracts, not liquid extracts in this case, in some of the capsules or the tablet that they tested, then no DNA would be present, and it would not necessarily show any of the echinacea or the St. John's wort. But if there had been other fillers added to the powdered extract in the capsule, because powdered extracts can sometimes be relatively concentrated, so they may not fill the entire capsule, so the manufacturer puts various types of fillers which may or may not be of plant origin, like rice powder and things like that, that are showing up in this paper. If they put the rice powder in there as a filler with the plant extract that the DNA would not detect, that DNA testing would not detect, then they're going to detect rice only. And in fact, that is what happened in a number of examples in this particular paper, which has informed some of these somewhat alarming conclusions. So it's very possible here. Now, Dr. Newmaster, one of the lead authors of the study, has said that they have not tested extracts. It's possible that could be a semantic confusion, because he may be thinking of extracts as being liquids like tinctures and some of these things you can buy in a health food store. Or he may not be aware that there are many dried powdered extracts found in herbal products sold in capsules and tablets that look very similar to dried herbal material. One of the co-authors of his paper actually told us, or told one of my co-authors in our critique at a United States Pharmacopeia workshop on adulteration that was held where I spoke, and where my co-author, who is an expert on DNA analysis over in Richmond, right across the bay from you all, told us that basically they had tested extracts. So it's confusing as to what was actually tested. And if extracts were in fact found in some of these products, in these capsules, even a dry extract, then this needs to be clarified. The authors of that paper should actually reveal the names, at least privately, so others can actually document what was actually in the products, and they should allow samples of their products to be tested in independent DNA labs and also by other methods. This question of methodology is something that is very unclear.
Mr. Blumenthal, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we've got somebody from the FDA, and I want to get his wisdom on this and hear from him. We'll come back to you, I want to come back to you because I know that some of your funding is coming from the industry, and if somebody else doesn't ask you that, I've got to ask you that. But let me go to Dr. Daniel Fabrikant, who is the Director of Dietary Supplement Programs for FDA at the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition. And Dr. Fabrikant, good to have you on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I guess initial question here is, it seems to be that the FDA would like to do more, but you don't have the resources.
Well, there's a lot of really good laws preventing me from talking about resources, so I can't really directly address that. But, you know, One out of every $4 in this country is spent on FDA-regulated goods. So it's, you know, we've got a wide array of business we need to take care of and ensure the American public is safe. And I think with supplements, we're certainly, you know, we've done a lot more, at least in my time at the agency, and we're always looking at ways to do more to ensure the public health.
But there are practices to prevent adulteration, and the rules are being ignored. And the New York Times had an article, they estimated 70% noncompliance.
Yeah, and they got that statistic from us. So we're aware of the problems. We're bringing cases, injunction cases, seizure cases for products that don't meet minimal quality standards. So we are out there, you know, looking to do something and looking to make sure that those folks that don't have any investment in meeting minimal basic quality standards, aren't going to be able to do business.
Well, I know you can't go into the specifics about your resources or lack of resources, but it seems like there's little regulatory oversight out there in terms of the selling or the marketing, and the products are only pulled when there are reports of serious injuries.
Well, I think where some of the confusion comes in is I think people look at a capsule, they look at a tablet, they think this is a medicine like what they get from their doctor that goes through FDA approval for safety and efficacy. That's not the case with dietary supplements. It is a post-market world. It is a category of food. So generally, our authorities are specific to when we do find a harm, we're compelled to act quickly. That doesn't mean we don't look to be preventive. And again, we certainly haven't been shy in the past few years about using the authorities we do have to keep consumers safe.
What assurances can consumers have? I mean, if you're looking at a label, how do they know, really, that they're going to get what's on that label or that they're going to get something that's not on that label?
Well, I think that's, I think one of the key things we advise consumers of is certainly talk to their physicians before they use a dietary supplement. They should kind of ask the question, why are they using it, and have a reasonable answer for that. I think they can certainly look at our actions against firms over the past few years and see, and see what some of the violations are that are out there, some of the things we see on GMP inspections, which are the standards firms have to meet for, again, minimal quality standards. We see that folks aren't conducting identity tests and things of that nature. I think when you see those sorts of violations, is that really someone you want to be buying anything from, whether it's a food, a dietary supplement, et cetera? So that's something we want people to keep in mind.
Well, they also should keep in mind, I imagine, I'd like to hear you affirm this or negate it if you feel it needs to be criticized, that the quality control and the policing in this industry suggests that it's operating on what is in effect an honor code, and there may not be as much honor as consumers would like.
Well, again, I mean, we do everything we can with the priorities we have and the resources we have. We have done quite a bit in terms of enforcement, especially in the past few years, bringing injunctions against firms for not meeting GMPs, seizing products that don't meet GMPs. So we take our role seriously, again, as resources and priorities allow.
Well, I thank you for joining us. Again, that's Dr. Daniel Fabrikant, who's Director of Dietary Supplement Programs for the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration at the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition. We also have Mark Blumenthal with us from the American Botanical Council and Candy Sirinis from UCSF School of Pharmacy. Candy Sirinis, you were nodding your head a lot vigorously there in that discussion.
Well, I come back to the issue of, while they're, as Dr. Blumenthal seemed to suggest, that, he's concerned about whether they tested extracts or not. And I appreciate that comment, but it still doesn't get to the point of what is on the label and if it's disclosed, if it matches what's inside that bottle. So for me, I'm concerned about all these soy-based fillers. I'm concerned about the rice fillers. I'm concerned about all of the products that are in there, and the consumer has no idea that they're getting it. And from as a pharmacist, that is serious to me. That is a concern. And while I appreciate, the recommendation that a consumer should take that product to their physician and have a discussion about the appropriateness of it, most healthcare providers don't know where to direct consumers because this marketplace, it's sort of like a few bad apples spoil the whole bunch. And so who
do you
trust?
Dr. David Baker said it's like the Wild West, and we're going to speak with him. But Mark Blumenthal, can you reassure the consumer? And again, I have to ask you, about where your funding's coming from.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that. We're very transparent. First of all, let me just say we're an independent science-based organization with members in 81 countries, scientists, researchers, all regulators, all kinds of people, industry people, et cetera. We have been working on and we've been around for 25 years as an independent organization. The industry has 5 trade associations. We're not one of those. They have their own representatives. We do not represent the industry. I just want to make that clear. For the last 3 years, we have set up an independent program called the Botanical Adulterants Program with the University of Mississippi, which has received funding from the Food and Drug Administration to do their testing for them and set up analytical methods for determining levels of contaminants and or adulterants in herbal and other dietary supplement products, and also with an independent group, nonprofit called the American Herbal Pharmacopeia. And we've been going out looking at this very problem of adulteration of ingredients in the dietary supplement industry. So we are actually out there trying to increase the quality and the quantity of information out there for industry benefit and others, consumers, at the end of the day.
So let me just ask you forthright, should consumers be concerned? I mean, it certainly sounds like they should be.
Well, consumers always need to be concerned about anything they're taking. I mean, after all, they use dietary supplements often as a form of self-medication, and our adage is self-medication requires self-education. And at the same time, we have pointed out a number of cases of adulteration, intentional adulteration, which is a form of fraud. This is not by accident. And this information is on our website at herbalgram.org on our adulteration page. And to your point about money, yes, we actually transparently show the various members of the dietary supplement community, as well as trade associations and professional organizations that are nonprofit, et cetera, independent laboratories that are supporting our international adulterations program, because our goal is to help increase awareness in the industry and in the other stakeholders, which includes health professionals like Candy and others, as to the extent of some of the problems with specific botanicals, so people can check with the company, check with their physician or their pharmacist or wherever they want to try to determine whether the product or the brand or the item they're taking can be considered
reliable. Let me just
ask
you to give your website, because I want to bring another voice into this then. If you would, give your website.
It's herbalgram.org, H-E-R-B-A-L-G-R-A-M, herbalgram.org. We have 5 articles we've published so far. They're extensive articles, 5 to 12,000 words each, extensively peer-reviewed by 8 to 10 different peer reviewers. They're free access on our website at the adulterants page, articles on adulteration, on the history of adulteration. By the way, we have an excellent article going back 2,000 years showing how people have cheated in the marketplace for herbs, spices, and botanical drugs. By substituting materials that the consumer or the patient doesn't know about. So we've been on this case for 3 years, and this is a multinational program that we're trying to do to educate the market to increase the quality of these products for the end result for the consumer. Our concern with the present paper, by the way, is that there are some of the data and some of the methods are still ambiguous and need to be clarified appropriately.
You've made those concerns patent here, but I'm just wondering, David Schock, for example, from the Center for Science and the Public Interest, says it's hard to recommend any herbal supplements to consumers.
Yeah, I know he said that, and of course that's the CSPI's position. David, by the way, is an old friend. I've known him for 40 years as Dr. Fabrikant. He used to be on my advisory board before he went to the Food and Drug Administration, and I know Dr. Sanura. So we're all colleagues here, and we're all basically, in my opinion, on the same side. We're all trying to find ways to improve the quality of information and the quality of products.
But let me ask you, would you agree with that statement? Is it hard to recommend any herbal supplements to consumers?
No, I don't believe that's true at all. As a matter of fact, I believe, for example, that there are a great many, not enough, but a great many herbal products that have been clinically tested, for example, using one of the most obvious criteria. And if you find products that have been clinically tested in published clinical trials, they generally tend to be very highly reliable and, in many cases, effective products for people to take. And I think that's one of the ways one people can determine whether a product is reliable. Another is to look for labels to see if they have a legitimate seal that shows that they've been authenticated by a third-party verification program, and we haven't talked about that.
Yeah, no, we can perhaps talk about that when it came up. This is the USP seal, the Dietary Supplement Verification Program, but what we're going to do actually when we come back is also talk to David Baker and bring you into this. In fact, I know many of you have questions and would like to join the conversation. You can do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us, 866-733-6786, by phone or email, forum@kqed.org, or on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about a new study that raises a number of questions about herbal supplements. The study is out of the University of Guelph in Canada, and it finds that many herbal supplements are diluted or replaced with fillers, such as wheat and rice, that aren't listed on their labels. And this is done by a technique called DNA barcoding, which researchers discovered, or through which they discovered, that many products were misleadingly labeled. And there are critics of the multi-billion-dollar-a-year supplement industry who's saying it's defrauding consumers and that the FDA regulation is inadequate. Industry groups claim the study is flawed. And we're discussing the findings and hearing both sides and trying to figure out what they mean, what the study means, or what, in general, the lack of regulations mean for consumers. And you may want to add your voice to this. In fact, we do welcome your calls and emails. And web postings, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Particularly interested in hearing perhaps from some of you who use herbal supplements or have had experiences one way or the other. I know there are many enthusiasts and certainly many critics out there and many who are probably ambivalent. But feel free to email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We're talking with Mark Blumenthal, founder and executive director of the American Botanical Council, and Candy Sarunas, who is the professor of clinical pharmacy at the UCSF School of Pharmacy. And we spoke earlier with Dr. Daniel Fabricant, who is with the FDA, Director of Dietary Supplement Programs there at the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition. I want to bring in your calls and emails and web postings, but before I do, I want to bring in Dr. David Baker, whom I alluded to earlier, who's an MD and professor in obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive medicine at Stony Brook University Medical Center in New York. He did a study on herbal supplement black cohosh for menopausal women. And Dr. Baker, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, and good to be on your program.
Well, I think I quoted you before by saying regulation for supplements out there is like the Wild West. Tell us why you see it that way.
I see it that way because it doesn't start with knowing what plant you're dealing with and that everything is geared at the other end, that if there is a problem with the supplement, then there is some action to remove the supplement from the market, rather than to make sure that the consumer, and I think we'll all agree, and I think the consumer will agree that they want to know that the plant that's in the bottle is the correct plant. So if they're buying ginkgo or ginseng or black cohosh, and the bottle says that there is black cohosh in that bottle, that they're actually taking a bottle that has black cohosh. So I think that's the basic thing that all of us want and the consumer wants, that when they take a capsule, it has that plant, that herbal supplement in it. So I think that's the major thing that I strive for. And that when I recommend or anyone recommends to take a supplement, it truly is that specific plant that's in that supplement.
Although could have a placebo effect, I'm saying facetiously, and probably in some instances does. But let me talk about your study with you for just a moment, because I know you bought 36 black cohosh supplements online and in chain stores and did these barcoding tests that we're talking about, and they showed that about a quarter of them were not black cohosh. They were ornamental plants from China that were in the ingredients.
That is correct. And the study with that was quoted from Canada is a little different than ours. And we used a barcoding method that was a little more sophisticated, that we basically went and got all the plants in the genus and all the species from Actia, which is the genus from black cohosh, and we actually sequenced all those plants and found a specific region that was specific for black cohosh. So we could identify specifically Actia racemosa or specifically black cohosh.
Can I ask you what you think about this study from the University of Guelph? I mean, you put credence in it, or do you have concern about the methods?
I put high credence to it because here again, we're using a technique that is looking at DNA sequencing. And DNA sequencing tells you exactly what plant you're looking for. It doesn't look at having a expert look at the flower, the bark, the seed, the leaf of a plant to differentiate whether that plant is black cohosh or one of the other very similar plants in that genus. It actually tells you the DNA makeup of that specific plant, and all plants, like all animal species, has a specific DNA makeup. So again, You're identifying a specific plant that you're looking for. And if you don't find that specific DNA sequence, then it's not that plant.
Again, Dr. David Baker.
An absolute way of finding what you're looking for.
Yeah, I was just going to ID you again, Dr. Baker, professor, Department of OBGYN at Stony Brook, and did a study on the herbal supplement, as he's been saying, black cohosh for menopausal women. I want to go to your calls, and let me do that and begin with Jason. Good morning.
Good morning. My name's Jason, and I get a monthly shipment from Dr. Andrew Weil. And I'm wondering if there's a way for a consumer to get a sample of supplements tested independently.
Candy, you want to take that?
Well,
because I mean, lots of stuff is going on from Andy Weil every day.
I don't know of any centers that independently test products for consumers, but maybe Mark or one.
No,
of the
Dr. Baker, do you know?
I do.
There is some ways of doing that, but again, they don't test whether there is the specific plant in that supplement. They test whether there is additives or there is contaminants, but at least at the current time, I don't think there is that set up to tell you whether there is that specific plant in that supplement at the current time.
Yeah, you want to add something here, Mark Blumenthal?
Yes, I'd like to respectfully disagree with all due respect. There are numerous independent analytical laboratories that can use chemical and now Dr. Danica Reynaud's company, Authent Technologies, in Richmond that can do DNA testing to authenticate medicinal plant material and other materials sold in dietary supplements, teas, etc. There are official government-sanctioned pharmacopeial methods for chemical tests that can be done to actually identify specific chemical compounds that either may be present or absent in different species of plant, like the Actaea species, of which black cohosh is a member that Dr. Baker's talking about. So there are numerous ways that governments rely on chemical testing that are listed in their official pharmacopeia and other compendias that are called compendial standards and compendial methods that many independent laboratories that people can hire, companies do this all the time for authentication and for quality control purposes, and they can use these methods. So, and these methods were totally ignored in the paper, by the way, that was we were talking about, the DNA paper by Newmaster.
Yeah, but what can the consumer? What can the consumer do?
Let me interrupt for one second. And they weren't ignored in my paper. And Dennis Stevenson and Damon Little. And if you look at our paper, it's clear that many plants in the same genus and many plants in different genuses and species produce the same biochemical substances and biochemical markers. And so this is the basic thing that with high-pressured liquid chromatography and thin-layered chromatography, you can get the same biochemical substances and markers from different plants. But what I'm saying, and I think what needs to be said emphatically, and what the barcoding papers say, and it's an addition, and I think that's the important part of this.
I also have to say emphatically that, you know, the consumer and the caller asked, you know, what can I do to find out? The consumer seems to be out on the margins here and doesn't necessarily...
That's right. What I'm saying is that the technology is such that you need to use this as a starting point and then use your biochemical markers to confirm that the plant you have is making the appropriate biochemical markers that are the active ingredients.
You can do that in a lab, Dr. Baker. If you're a consumer, though, you're buying things at the local health food store. You don't necessarily know anything about that. Candy,
that is correct.
Well, I just want to bring a little levity to this discussion because the average consumer is not going to know where to go. Number one, that they can take whatever they bought at their local grocery store and is not going to know where exactly that they can take this product to be tested, nor that there's a possibility that it could be tested. And so, you know, what we're talking about here, while I appreciate this particular consumer's question. It's a very valid one. You know, this person is informed and concerned and wants to make sure that they're getting the right product. But the average person's not going to know to do that. And so, you know, this just tells me that we're 20 years after the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act was passed, we have not seen progress. I mean, we've seen some, but products are still contaminated. Products are not what is represented on the label, and we need to make some changes. This is absolutely not acceptable.
Let me bring another caller on here. Eric, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Michael. You know, I've been taking supplements for, you know, I'm in my late 50s, and I've been taking supplements for, I would say, a good 15 years now. The variety of supplements I take could be like glucosamine, MSM, chondroitin combinations in the morning. I take DHEA. I take coenzyme Q10. Some of these, resveratrol. I do my own research. I have enough literature available online and through some of the these companies that give me a fairly decent knowledge of what I'm getting. I'm not saying that I'm going to 100% knowledge, but, you know, regulating all these things again and pulling a lot of these things off the market, I think is not right for somebody who chooses to get educated and get the supplements that help them. Glucosamine, MSM, chondroitin, for example, there's a lot of controversy about that. But, I mean, I know for sure my knees were popping and cracking, you know, 5 years ago, and I play a lot of tennis. I wouldn't have been able to play tennis today if I wasn't taking that supplement, which totally relieved all these issues within 3 weeks. I mean, it was just a straightforward result. I used to take T-boosters a long time ago, and now all of a sudden a T-booster is a testosterone natural booster. Athletes abuse that, you know, in a big way, and they took that off the market. Unfortunately, that was a few cases that were abused. Now everybody can't take that anymore.
So forgive me, Eric. So because it's working for you, you don't feel there's a necessity for regulation? Why would there be the harm of more regulation? I'm not clear on why you feel.
Because what happens is the tendency is to overregulate and take a lot of things off the market for people that, you know, for the majority of people where the majority is not really the problem. It's just a few cases that are off. I mean, a lot of prescription drugs out there are okay, and they have a lot more damage. Like statins cause damage to liver damage. You have, you know, abuse situations with prescription drugs. I'm just saying it's not. I don't think it's the answer. If there's a new regulation, let's not go overboard and just keep people educated and buy these products from American companies, or try it and just use common sense. Is what I'm saying. I mean, a lot of stuff is experimental. I understand, but like resveratrol, DHEA, conglosamine combinations with MSM, those have been out for a long time, and it would be a shame to take all those off the market and have to have prescriptions to take those.
Right, I get your point. Of course, you get liver damage from niacin or alcohol for that matter, but Candy Sarunas, you want a word in here?
Well, I'm not saying that we need to pull these products from the market. I think the discussion is that, you know, clearly the manufacturing needs to be improved. We need to ensure that the products that are on the market are made in a responsible way, that the ingredients are listed on the label, that there's nothing additional, and that nothing has been substituted. And we're just not there yet. And the caller makes a good point. I mean, he brought up some of the supplements that actually have some data to support their use. Glucosamine chondroitin has a lot of literature available. And I would even submit to you that this is a good example of where the literature is sort of on either side, saying it's a benefit and maybe no benefit. And that has a lot to do with how that glucosamine is manufactured.
Well, speaking of either side, let me read some emails here. This is Russ who writes, two issues are being conflated here. One is whether herbal supplements work. The other is the fact that some herbal manufacturers are selling fake products. By refusing to name the bad manufacturers, the authors of the study harm the entire industry, which makes me suspect to their plan. If they want to help consumers, they should tell them who was making the bad products. Another listener writes, it's funny how often these studies, which are entirely appropriate, are done by entities that are either outside the USA entirely or outside of American academia. Within the USA, the long arm of corporate money and intimidation seems to dampen much that should be done to protect the public. And Nafis writes to us, consumers are at the mercy of whatever is on their shelves. For 90% of herbal medicine, the risks are financial. People are buying what is literally diluted colorants. If the FDA is helpless vis-a-vis the big pharmaceuticals and the food industry, and its role at best is to be an arbiter for voluntary confirmation, then how could it regulate something far on the margins? And Jim sends this email. Can someone explain why the FDA spokesperson can't talk about its level of funding? The FDA spokesperson on the show said that there are laws preventing him from discussing the FDA's level of funding and level of enforcement. What's that about? And shouldn't that information be made public? Well, he did say that, and I don't have answers for you. We don't have him. We said goodbye to him, but we'll see what we can find out. In the meantime, we'll get a caller from up in Canada. Cher, where are you? What province are you in?
Hi, I'm calling from Victoria, B.C., and I used to live in California, and I'm moving back next year. Yay. I just wanted to, I had to step in and say something because I've worked in the supplement industry in Canada and the U.S., and I'm writing a book. And the thing is, it's not so much the herbs themselves. What the problem is that all these big corporations have this beautiful window dressing, and they're in the supplement industry. And I've been involved with the supplement industry since the 70s. And, you know, I miss those granola days. Now it's kind of like, you know, supermarkets, and some of these companies have horrific records environmentally, to say the least.
Yeah, I said health food stores before, and I realize how arcane that sounds, or
well,
anachronistic even.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, and I'm writing a book about all this because I just couldn't keep quiet. You know, when I open up a health food magazine that, you know, it's full of ads and stuff, and I see a company that I know, you know, is so just, you know, they're such a bad company, and they're, you know, putting out an ad for, you know, we want everything labeled for GMOs and stuff, and they're not, that's not what they're about. And I wish I could say more, but the book will come out next year. But the other thing, too, that I want to speak on is because I've worked both sides of the fence, I don't want to see a whole bunch of over-regulating in the states for one reason. They do this in Canada, and the thing that really sucks is that they're not reasonable about it. And, you know, they cut us off a kava, which is just beautiful for sleeping. I use the essential oil. You know, it's just a really good herb for relaxation, but they just go overboard up here. They don't allow it, and then all the little Canadians run to the States and buy kava and bring it up, you know, under their arms and in their socks. And, you know, it just doesn't make any kind of sense. So, you know, they're crazy here. And me, I would love to do a supplement company, but I can't do something like that here because it's so overregulated that someone like me could never set up. But
well, get your book done first, Cher. Then you'll have some credibility. Yeah, you'll have some credibility. Then you can open up a. And thank you for the call. Actually, I want to go to another caller, somebody else who works in the industry. Gabrielle, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. And I'd like to say hi to Mark. I've known him for many years as somebody who's been in the industry for a while, and his father's been in the industry for a while as well. I just wanted to make a comment about how, you know, not knowing what's going into your materials. I work for a raw material ingredient company, and we supply botanical extracts to ingredient manufacturers in the industry. And we take our role as an ingredient supplier very seriously. When we bring our materials in, first of all, we only sell extracts, which guarantee a minimum level of potency and cleanliness from contaminants such as heavy metals and pesticides and solvent residues and other things. Extracts function somewhat differently from raw material powders, which have some benefits but also some other challenges in terms of quality control. We take very seriously
I've got to stop you there, Gabrielle, because I thought this testing can find substances in supplements, but not necessarily their potency. How do you determine the potency?
Well, there's various ways to test for potency, and it depends on the extract itself. There's UV vis testing. There's HPLC testing, and
yeah,
it really.
I'm gonna ask a question too. Where do you get your raw materials from?
We bring our raw materials in from China, but we
Who tests the raw materials before you extract them from?
Yeah, we're getting a lot of stuff from China that's pretty toxic, you know, like cat food and things like. I'm sorry,
you
but
get from China what you look for. But basically, we test the raw material before it leaves port in China. We test it for identity. We test it for potency.
How
we test
pesticide
residues. I would appreciate being able to finish my statement before questions are asked. We test residues, we test solvents, we test heavy metals, we test pesticides, we test for microbes. Once we bring the material in, we quarantine that material in our facility until we repeat the testing stateside. We use very reputable laboratories, third-party laboratories in the States. We also have in-house.
All right, Gabrielle, I'm going to have to interrupt you because I think Dr. Baker has some serious concerns about what you're saying here, and I'd like to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, but you don't test whether you have the right plant.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. I'd like to say something about this, if I may, please.
But you don't use barcoding, or you don't use a way of testing. You have a powder, or you have a ground-up material, and you don't know if you have the right plant.
Well, Dr. Baker, let me just jump in here. This is Mark Blumenthal again. I think the young lady is speaking from a position of a company that does a great deal of diligence, as do many other reputable companies, to ensure that they have the right plant based on a number of widely accepted methodologies, including but not limited to some of the chemical testing protocols that she mentioned. I understand that you are strongly in favor of DNA barcoding, and frankly, we have published two papers in our peer-reviewed journal supporting the use of DNA barcode testing as another and highly reliable form of testing when, again, it's fit for purpose. It is not always fit for purpose, and in her case, extracts are not appropriate for DNA testing, which I'm sure you're aware, because the DNA is not in the extract. Now, I'm sure there are other ways of testing plant material. One of them is organoleptic, microscopic, as well as chemical. And the real way to do this is through using a suite, a combination of microscopic, if powder is available and the plant's available, because microscopy also reveals the cell structure of the plant, as well as chemical testing, plus the DNA test.
I think Dr. Baker is going through a little bit of a primal response here. Dr. Baker, let me hear from you, but first I want to hear from Candy Sarunas, who wanted to add something here.
I just wanted to add that this discussion that we're having is exactly the result of an unregulated marketplace. The fact that we have good companies who are doing the right thing, who have the right experts on board and are making quality product, and then you have the dietary supplement companies who have no expertise, are out to make money, and are doing the wrong thing. And so as a consumer, now I'm faced with, who do I trust? How do I know that this manufacturer is doing all the right things that Mark says we should do? And how do I know that Company Z over here is not doing the right thing? It is exactly the result of what we're seeing right now. This is exactly it.
Go ahead, Dr. Baker.
Candy, I think we don't want to be careful about using the term unregulated marketplace. There are numerous regulations that Dr. Fabrikant and his organization.
I misspoke.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm glad you made that correction.
Underregulated.
David Baker wanted to add. So David Baker, please.
Yeah, I just want to, you know, emphasize one thing, and I don't want to be contrary. I'm just saying that if something's coming from China ground up, and the paper from Canada is an example that if you're getting a raw material, what technology is there to assure that that raw material is the correct plant? And what I'm saying is the technology of looking for biochemical markers is not enough to ensure that you have the right plant.
All right, we have other callers who would like in, and Ken, that's you next. Good morning. Welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Good morning. There are no standards, and you haven't mentioned, I was a project manager for a supplement company in the late 90s, and in the late 90s, I do recall there was the 2020 TV show with John Stossel did a report on supplements where they tested them for the amount of active ingredients or claimed ingredients in the product. And they even had Dr. Weil on as a guest, and they shocked him by revealing that his own named branded supplements had less than 10% of the active ingredients. And this was found all over, and I don't think they tested for adulteration, but the active ingredients were not what were claimed on there. As a project manager who was trying to make or import or get manufactured, I should say, a supplement called calcium pyruvate, the one that we had sourced from China was smelled so full of solvent that the certificate of analysis supplied with it, and you haven't mentioned that as a key thing from a lab that shows what's in the stuff that you're buying as a manufacturer. The certificates of analysis can be bogus, but that is something that even the manufacturer should be able to rely on. Can you comment on certificates of analysis? Are they the gold standard?
I'm glad you brought that up. We're running out of time, Kent, so I want to and thank you for bringing it up, because I want to get some things on the record, as I said earlier, about the USP seal and just what validates supplement verification. There's voluntary testing in this, and it's an entirely voluntary program. But essentially,
so I can respond to that question, though.
Go ahead, Mark.
First of all, we are coming out with a book next year on solvent residues and solvents used in the botanical extraction industry. It's we've been working on it for 3 years. It's almost ready for production. It's going out for its third round of peer review. So we are, this organization is an independent organization, the American Botanical Council, is aware of the issue of solvents, and we're helping to clarify that. With respect to third-party verification programs, like the United States Pharmacopeia, USP, Dietary Verification, NSF, and others, these are legitimate symbols on the side of the package or on the label that indicate that they have been monitored and or audited for their manufacturing facility, and in some cases the actual product has been tested for authentication.
So they are there for the consumer, although again they're voluntary, and we've come to the end of this hour. I want to thank you, Mark Blumenthal from the American Botanical Society. Also, thanks to Candy Sarunas here in studio, Professor of Clinical Pharmacy at UCSF School of Pharmacy, and Dr. David A. Baker, who joined us from Stony Brook, Professor in the Department of OBGYN, and Dr. Daniel Fabricant from the FDA, Director of Dietary Supplement Programs. You can continue this discussion on our website. In fact, we enjoin you to do that, and we've got another hour of forum coming up. Former Poet Laureate Billy Collins joins us in the hour ahead. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.